The Word of Mouth podcast is brought to you by
Dartmouth Hitchcock, creating a new model for healthcare,
where leading health systems collaborate
to improve care for all of us.
A sustainable system improving the health of our communities for years to come.
Information at imagine.d-h.org.
Word of Mouth.
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 Word of
Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. New Hampshire's first-in-the-nation primary has created a number of campaign traditions, rituals that even the most unconventional candidates have to follow.
I'm Katie Turr following Donald Trump, where today in New Hampshire he did what his campaign vowed he'd never do. Visit a diner.
Donald Trump from New York. Let's give him a welcome, Donald!
Whether it's a visit to the Red Arrow Diner in Manchester, the Dairy Twirl in Lebanon, or Howard's up in Colebrook, you cannot campaign for president in New Hampshire without taking in some of the local flavor. And it is not just about maintaining enough calories for stumping. The diner primary is about putting yourself eye to eye with New Hampshire voters hungry for a side of retail politics. Darren Garnick is a writer and contributor to New Hampshire Magazine, where he recently wrote about the relationship between food and the first-in-the-nation primary. And Darren, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Virginia.
So stopping at a diner is an essential part of retail politics here in New Hampshire. But so far, candidate Bernie Sanders, has he shown up at a diner?
I've never seen Bernie at a diner, and I've never heard of him being at a diner. It's not really his style. He's Mr. Serious, Mr. Stiff, and he's been forced to take selfies and be a little bit more loose because his base is so young. But he hates diners, from what I understand.
So he has not had to cave. Well, Darren, in your article, you admit to having primary fever. How has the greasy spoon experience figured into your own primary experience?
So I love the primary, and I love following candidates at diners because as much as it's a propaganda backdrop, it's an unparalleled opportunity for us to get in front of the next president of the United States and ask them anything. Once they go into the bubble and get elected, we'll never get anywhere close to them. There are people with autograph books. There are people who bring giant photographs framed just ready for the candidate, like they've been waiting years for this moment. And then there are people who had no idea that the candidate was going to barge through the door. I met a woman at Chez Vachon in Manchester, and she has Lyme disease, and she got to ask Rand Paul about Lyme disease face-to-face, and that's just not an issue that's going to come up at the debates. And even though she didn't get a magic answer about he supports funding for research, she just felt that she was being listened to and she was satisfied.
Well, you write about how some candidates really get this, and Senator Joe Biden in 2011 really hammed it up at a campaign stop. Now, do you think that there are some candidates that do especially well in these kind of situations?
Oh, absolutely. Some of the restaurant owners and waitstaff are the stars of this article in New Hampshire Magazine, and I really enjoyed hearing their memories. John McCain was known to go into places like the Puritan Backroom and just eat chicken tenders off people's plates.
That's a nice touch. How about not to campaign at a diner? I'm thinking Bill de Blasio cutting his pizza with a knife and fork, that kind of thing.
Well, you know, it's interesting because you very rarely see candidates eat at diners. And I think the reason is because everybody looks very unflattering when they're photographed with their mouth full of with food or chewing or with their mouth open. So it's very refreshing to see news reports when the candidates actually do sit down and eat. There's a great photo in New Hampshire Magazine taken by Rick Friedman. He's a Boston photographer, and it's of Barack Obama at the Portsmouth Brewery, and he has a burger in one hand, and his other hand he's shaking hands with a voter. And it really just summed up for me, like, these guys and women, they can't even rest. They're constantly on, and they're constantly being watched. But that's what they sign up for.
Well, in 2008, here's a New Hampshire diner moment that went viral. Mitt Romney, he sat down with an older gentleman. He was wearing a flannel shirt and a hat, I think a pack of cigarettes in his pocket, identified himself as a New Hampshire veteran. After a little bit of banter about his service, the man asked Romney if he supported gay marriage. So let's hear what happened.
And we apparently disagree on that.
It's good to know how you feel that you do not believe that
everyone is entitled to their constitutional rights.
No, actually, I think at the time the Constitution was written, it was pretty clear that marriage is between a man and a woman, and I don't believe the Supreme Court has changed that.
Governor, we got to get on with Fox News right now.
Okay. Oh, I guess the question was too hot.
No, I gave you the
answer.
I'll
have a good day.
You said you had a yes or no answer. I gave you the yes.
You did, and I appreciate your answer.
Thank
and you know, I also learned something, and New Hampshire is right. You have to look a man in the eye to get a good answer. And you know what, Governor? Good luck.
Thank you. Appreciate it. Have a good day to you,
You're
sir.
You're going
to
need it.
Thank you. You are right about that.
Okay, so what did that reveal to you about the Diner primary?
Well, so Romney was known for not talking to the media at all. And this really shows you how anybody, if you get there early in a Diner and you grab a booth, you can ask the candidates anything, and it's an unscripted moment. Carl Cameron from Fox and former from WMUR 9, he told me that this is what candidates fear. They fear the unscripted moment. They fear not having a soundbite ready to go, and anything can happen in a Diner.
Mm. Here in New Hampshire, you cannot run for president without a cup of coffee and a side of bacon. Darren Garnick is with me. He's joining us as a writer and contributor to New Hampshire Magazine. And we're talking about the Diner primary, where candidates do come face-to-face with hungry New Hampshire voters, never quite sure what they're going to say. There are some top campaign spots that we hear about. The Red Arrow Diner in Manchester, certainly an obvious one. What are some of the other classic campaign stops around the state?
So I love diners and restaurants that double as museums. When you walk in there, there's not a square inch of empty space on the walls, and you see, you know, primaries from years back. There's only a few of those places left. Red Arrow Diner is one of them. What I love about the Red Arrow Diner is you can sit at the lunch counter and you can see there's like an engraved plate with like a celebrity's name on it. So you can sit where the Bare Naked Lady sat, or you can sit where Rudy Giuliani sat. And one of the cool things I found out was Red Arrow just renovated its counter and just, you know, ripped it up and put down a new one. They took away John Edwards' plate, the shameful plate, you know, committed adultery, used campaign money to pay off his mistress. And they replaced it with RuPaul.
That's pretty good. Okay, so we've got the Red Arrow. Lindy's
and Keene is awesome because they've embedded the tabletops with photos from Lindy's Diner posing with the waitresses and owner. So you'll see Barack Obama, Paul Tsongas, Bob Dole, and they've really embraced the role of being a stop on the primary. And I wish more restaurants and diners would do that. A lot of places, they've had a lot of famous visitors, but you would never know it by going into the restaurant.
Well, we know we're living in a pretty divisive sort of partisan political atmosphere. Do you think there are some diners and eating establishments that are kind of known as, you know, GOP or Democratic leaning?
So every diner I've been into for a political appearance, the owners told me they'll welcome everyone. And I think that that's more of New Hampshire people just taking a responsibility of an ownership of the primary. There's a guy who owns Foodie's Pizza in Milford, and he's very well known as a Republican activist. And he told me he would have any presidential candidate, and it would be an honor to host other candidates from other parties because he was participating in our democracy.
Okay, so how about North Country stops? Any hot spots up there for candidates?
So when I think of the North Country, the first place that I think of that I love is that old hotel, the Balsams, which has a room in Dixville Notch, where the ballot room where everybody votes first, the town votes first. But that's closed too. You can't even go in there because the hotel is being sold and renovated. So, you know, that's up in the air. So these places are endangered species, and that's why I wish more restaurants and diners would step up and celebrate their primary heritage.
It is something funny to me that it does have to be a diner and not, well, you know, they do go to the Puritan, I suppose, the more standard sit-down style restaurant. But it could actually be spun as kind of a negative, you know, if a candidate insisted on going someplace fancy to eat.
Well, I don't know. I mean, the common man I wouldn't call super fancy, but that's a pretty nice restaurant. And they get a lot of candidates in there. And the Tuscan Kitchen in Salem, that's high-end. And they've been hosting a lot of town meeting type events.
Do you know if a candidate has ever been successful in the New Hampshire primary without making these requisite diner stops?
well, Donald Trump is hugely successful without doing diner stops. He made one at the Red Arrow, and it was a very embarrassing moment for him. Somebody in the restaurant said, "Enjoy your burger, racist." It's a risk. If you're unpopular or you're controversial, when you go into that diner, you better be ready to hear anything and be able to respond to anything. Very similar to what Mitt Romney ran into.
But Darren, something about food, do you think, about a public meal that reveals another side of a candidate, you know, in that diner situation? Or do you think it's about that small space and that setting that sets these kind of stops apart?
Yeah, I think it's forced intimacy. You walk into the Red Arrow Diner when there's no primary, you know, it's not even lunch hour, and you can touch both sides of the walls when you stick out your hands. And so imagine Mother's Day, the biggest crowd on Mother's Day, and then add 50 reporters to that. It's claustrophobia in there. And so there's no way for the candidate not to have an intimate moment with a voter. It's a built-in feature of these diners' appearances.
Darren Garnick, he's a contributor to New Hampshire Magazine. Thank you.
Thank you.
In the winter of 1977, residents of Martha's Vineyard were outraged. A bill in the Massachusetts state legislature proposed stripping them of their one state representative, effectively lumping the island into a larger Cape Cod district. Vineyard selectmen proposed a radical solution, secession. Producer Sally Helm brings us the story of a rift in the union.
Before we get into the whole secession thing, we need to say a few words about people from Martha's Vineyard.
Martha's Vineyards have their own style.
I see strong people.
Completely independent.
Tough bunch, very tough. My grandfather couldn't complete a sentence without cussing.
Vineyarders aren't the type to take an insult sitting down. And in 1977, the state of Massachusetts lobbed a big insult their way. Martha's Vineyard had always had its own state legislator. But now, there was this redistricting bill on the table, and Massachusetts said they were too small for that. So they had to share a representative. Too small, Martha's Vineyard said. Too small? Oh no. No way.
'Twas the big freeze of 77. A group got together numbering about 11. The farmers, the fishermen, selectmen too. Islanders all to decide what to do.
It was a rainy, cold night.
The meeting happened to be held in the Chilmark Community Center.
It was a cold February night up in Chilmark where it all began.
We all talked about the few mundane issues that we had, and then secession.
Everett Poole was the guy who first brought it up.
I wanted to wind the damn meeting up so I could go home.
Everett says the selectmen argued for a long time about how they could respond to losing their representative. Then he stood up and said, "If we don't get our own representation, we should secede from the state." He wasn't joking.
Yankees are not over-demonstrative, you know.
Well, except for the occasional secession flare-up that they get.
Well, that wasn't being over-dramatic at all. That was just nuts and bolts. We are ourselves, and we should be represented as such.
Us younger zealots thought this was the avenue.
That's John Alley. He was one of the youngest selectmen at the meeting.
Older people, I've gotten to be older now, sense that let's not upset the apple cart.
John's 73 now, but when he left that meeting, he was ready to tip over a million apple carts if he had to. He sent word to the press. The All Island Selectmen's Association had voted to leave the state and start their own.
A rallying cry was heard the aisle through. It's time to secede from you know who.
In retrospect, goddamn, we've unraveled a can of worms here. Well, we didn't know that then. I named a ruling junta. Joe Salito, he was then the head of the Selectmen Association, so he became the head of the ruling junta.
At the time, Joe was the clerk of the county court.
We talked about establishing a Supreme Court, and I said if they did that, then I'd like to be the Chief Justice.
Joe voted for secession that night in Chilmark. The next morning, he woke up and went about his normal business.
I was at work here and I started getting telephone calls from radio stations. And they started asking me questions about it, and from there it took off.
The Boston Globe picked up the story. Then it was on the NBC Nightly News. And at town meetings across the vineyard, there were landslide votes in support of secession. In Edgartown, it was 213-33. Only 33 people voted against it. Meanwhile, at the State House in Boston, the Vineyard's representative lobbied hard to defeat the redistricting bill. He was quoted in the Vineyard Gazette comparing the secession movement to the American Revolution. Back on the island, John Alley remembers being in his general store when the phone rang.
This man told me he was the governor of Vermont, and I said, yes, and I'm the king of England, and I hung up.
The governor called back and said, no, no, it's really me. I want to annex the vineyard. Vermont relies on winter tourism, so the governor wanted a seashore to balance things out. Then Hawaii sent its welcome, and Connecticut, and New Hampshire. Joe got a proclamation of support from Tennessee.
And whereas a band of rebellious islanders is preparing for independence to the extent that a new flag has been designed, proposals for gambling casinos are circulated, and applications for ambassadorial posts have been submitted. And whereas...
Tennessee wasn't joking. Someone had designed a new state flag, a seagull flying across an orange sun. And, of course, there was the state anthem.
Onward, steadfast for the right, keep your vigil through the night. From East Choplai to Menemshabite, keep our little island tight.
It perhaps was overstated, but we had a legitimate reason for secession. That seemed to be the only channel in which you could be heard by the state officials in charge
of
all this.
It couldn't have been the only channel, right? There could have been like a write a letter, but why didn't you want to do
We've all written. Don't get this wrong. Letters were written, official letters with a stamp and all that. It didn't amount to hill of beans.
In the end, even the secession movement couldn't stop the bill that was going to strip the vineyard of their representative. Despite all the votes and the lobbying, the redistricting bill passed the legislature in May. The governor signed it, and the hopes for a vineyard representative were pretty much over. They did get something. The legislature agreed to give the vineyard a legislative liaison, who would sort of be their voice in Boston, but without an actual vote. And the vineyard's reaction was, okay. A lot of people were losing interest in the whole thing anyway. Plus, summer was coming.
It just slowly died away and we got back into doing our regular things that we usually did.
But you could have been Chief Justice of the court.
I'm happy with the job that I have.
You wouldn't have wanted to be governor?
It would have been fun to do something like that. But in reality, it's really a lot of headaches.
Do you think if secession came up now, how would you react?
I'd probably, number one, be against it. But number two, because I know how complicated and the process and the steps you have to go through.
So you'd be against it now?
Well, you know, I'm older now. And hell, I've been around a while and we were beginning to learn that the long road really went on and on and on and on. So what do? You cut your losses and you get on with things.
Everett Poole, the guy who first proposed secession, says he's done with political kerfuffles.
I'm over the hill. I'm fast going down the other side. And it's younger people are going to make the decisions now, not me. Not anybody my age.
John agrees.
Ultimately, we achieved our pretty much all of our goal, and stepped aside. And God bless the young bucks.
A few weeks back, I brought the Martha's Vineyard state anthem to Stupid Fun Karaoke Night, which happens every week at a bar in Oak Bluffs. I wanted to know how the young bucks today feel about secession. They were pretty practical. It would be hard to reorganize everything, and where would they get the money? But here and there, the idea of secession found some support.
I kind of do wish that we had our own little, right?
Yeah.
No one else was allowed.
Do you?
I guess it would be pretty cool now that I'm thinking about it.
If any part of Massachusetts should be independent, it should be this place.
Secession's the answer. We could take no more.
Secession, the answer. We could take no more.
Take no more.
Take no more. Take no more.
John and Joe have just one thing to say to anyone take who would no think more. About secession.
Good luck.
Good luck.
I will take no more.
And that story was produced by Sally Helm. Nate Barnett voiced the Martha's Vineyard state anthem.
Word of mouth.
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 Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Since leaking classified NSA documents to the media, Edward Snowden has become the poster child for citizen rights to privacy. But there was a group of vocal critics rallying against government surveillance long before Snowden blew the whistle, librarians. Allison Macrina is a library, a privacy activist, and founder and director of the Library Freedom Project, which has fought to protect the privacy of library users across the country from government surveillance. And Allison, welcome to Word of Mouth. I want to go back to 2001. Now, this is when the Patriot Act was first signed into law, immediately causing concerns among members of the American Library Association. So what was the issue?
Well, I think that librarians as a group recognized pretty quickly the possibilities present in the USA Patriot Act for mass surveillance. And we were collectively really outraged that this massive piece of legislation had gone through with no one reading it or really considering what could possibly happen. And so as a profession, we fought back pretty loudly. ALA made a number of statements. Individual libraries started to do things like purge user records. And it became such a big thing that it actually got the attention of former Attorney General John Ashcroft, who dismissed our concerns by saying we were just a bunch of hysterical librarians.
Hysterical being a key word there, huh?
Yeah. Yeah. You know, profession of women call us hysterical. We made T-shirts that said another hysterical librarian for privacy after that, which was a kind of a cool answer to the Attorney General.
I remember him saying something like, well, we don't want to know who, you know, how far along you are in your John Grisham novel. But there were other things at stake. And I guess this is just one of a long line of privacy fights that dates back to the Cold War.
So what's really unique about the library profession is that we've named privacy as one of our professional core values since the earliest days of the American Library Association, since the 1930s. And so every time something like this comes up, we see the impact that it has for a democratic society. During the Cold War, we came out with this really amazing statement called the Freedom to Read Statement that was a response to McCarthyism and the whole sort of anti-communist fervor that we know now was actually very problematic for free speech and free expression. And so we recognized that even back then, even when it was very, you know, unpopular to criticize that kind of thinking, we said, no, this is not okay. You know, we have a right under the Constitution to believe whatever we want, and the government cannot restrain us from that. And so you've seen this really great continuation of it in the profession since then.
At that time, though, I'm guessing that, yes, the government could tell if you'd, you know, read Lady Chatterley's Lover or the Communist Manifesto. Mm-hmm. When we say library records now, what's on the record?
Well, I guess the fundamental difference is that you're talking about digital records, and we know that as soon as you digitize something, as soon as you make it possible to connect that information to the internet, the capabilities for surveillance just amplify massively. And so the library records that are contained digitally are, of course, all of the old records, you know, personally identifiable information about patrons, what people have checked out, and then a number of other things connected to electronic records, you know, databases and interlibrary loans. As, of course, we live in the information age, you know, the amount of information that we consume has just grown massively. And so our data trails have followed suit.
I know that a lot of people do use libraries, especially low-income people tend to use libraries mm-hmm. for their computers. Are those computers subject to the same kind of scrutiny?
It's a great point to make, that especially the people who really rely on libraries for their computing are people who might not have any access to it anywhere else. And those people tend to be people who are subject to surveillance in a way that the general population is not, right? I mean, economic justice and surveillance are things that are very related. So the data trail then is becomes sort of, you know, who logged into the computer when, how much time they spent, what they did when they went on there. And so librarians have this imperative to purge those records, because that's compelling information to law enforcement and to intelligence agencies.
But under the Patriot Act, you were required to share records from what your patrons were doing?
We would have been required to share that information if it was requested from us and if we had kept it. And that last part is really the essential thing. If we don't have the data, we can't share it. And as a profession, we realized that one way that we could fight back against this is just getting rid of the information as a start. You know, if it's not there, it cannot be subpoenaed.
So now, Provision 215 of the Patriot Act, it expired in June, I believe. So are libraries just sort of off the hook for sharing data on patrons now?
You know, not at all. Unfortunately, the thing about the various surveillance authorizations is that 215 was just one of many. It wasn't even the only one that dealt with telephony metadata in bulk. You know, there's Mystic was another one, for example. Other things that are covered by Executive Order 12333 that weren't even, that predate the Patriot Act provisions. And so, you know, it's 215. I'm very glad that 215 was sunsetted, although it's sort of back in zombie form in the Freedom and the USA Freedom Act.
So any sense, Allison, of how often the government has requested those library records?
It's a great question, and it's a hard question to answer because of the gag order provisions that are present in some of these info requests. So one of the most better known info requests that also actually predates the Patriot Act was the national security letters. And national security letters are this is especially insidious kind of information request, because you get one of these things and it says in there, you know, you have to give up this information and you can't tell anyone that you received this letter. So the ACLU has been working on this for years now, and they don't have any good data about how often NSLs go out. Now, they generally go to software providers and places like that. The Internet Archive has received one, as far as I know. I'm pretty sure they did. But we do know that at least one group of librarians received an NSL because they fought back against it, and that's the Connecticut Four. But, yeah, it's hard because, you know, you get one of these things. You're a librarian. You want to comply with the law, and you've never seen such a thing before, and it says you're not allowed to tell anyone that you got it. It doesn't clarify that your legal counsel, you're allowed to tell them. So it's very frightening stuff.
Where is the battleground of the citizen privacy versus government surveillance fight? Well, among them, your local library. We're talking to Allison Macrina, who's founder and director of the Library Freedom Project, and she's among those who have been destroying personal records rather than giving them over to the government. Well, the Connecticut Four, after a long, long legal battle, the case actually, I think, was dismissed on a technicality. But, you know, the Patriot Act is intended to keep Americans safe. Has the interception of library records ever led to good or actionable intelligence?
Well, you know, there's a local level of where this is appropriate, and that is if a police officer has a warrant and they're investigating a crime and they're looking for some information in a kind of, you know, gumshoe detective work, that's an appropriate use of a law enforcement request. The problem is that with the mass surveillance that Snowden revealed, we know that that's not how our law enforcement agencies and intelligence agencies are behaving. They are siphoning up all this information. And so we don't want to get in the way of law enforcement doing the job that they're supposed to do. We want them to perform their duties, you know, and remember the oath that they made to the Constitution. But they're not doing that. And so we have to take measures to protect our communities.
But how about you on that local level? I mean, I can't help but think, you know, we know that ISIS has done a lot of recruiting online. We know that people are looking for, you know, safe, untraceable computers to do that on. So if somebody were indeed plotting at a local library, wouldn't you want to know?
Sure, absolutely. But the thing is, that's not happening. You know, ISIS is a great example because they're, you know, the threat of ISIS is something that's used over and over again of, you know, why we need to have perpetual access to all records all the time. But we've seen that ISIS isn't even obscuring their information with any serious, meaningful tools. They're not even using them. They're using WhatsApp. They're using Facebook. They're doing everything right out in the open. The other thing is that the internet is a very hostile place as far as our privacy and security is concerned. And ordinary people like you and I, who are not committing any crimes, are under threat of our privacy and security being violated because of how the internet is designed. And so the best way that we can protect ourselves is to use tools that obscure our information, to use things like the Tor browser to protect our personally identifiable information online, to use things like encryption and HTTPS, because the threat of things like fraud and identity theft and other kinds of exploitation are so great. Those are the bigger social problems that I'm concerned with addressing, because we have real evidence that that's happening all the time. You know, that is my real focus.
We should mention the Tor browser used here in Lebanon, New Hampshire, of all places.
That's right.
It's just so interesting to think of libraries as, you know, a sort of battleground for this. And it's a very politically charged issue. Are librarians political, do you think, inherently?
I think so. I mean, I think, you know, you have to consider, this is what I say to people all the time, libraries didn't exist. And someone came to you today in 2016 and said, I'm going to start a project where there's a building and it's filled with information and books and computers and resources, and anyone can use it, and it's totally free. You don't have to buy anything. You don't even have to be a taxpayer in that community. You can just come and be there, and you don't even have to touch the information. You can just sit in the chair all day and just exist. That would never happen. You know, it wouldn't be something that we'd create now. So I tend to think that the very idea of libraries is a very radical notion. It's like applied socialism, you know? And so I know many librarians who maybe don't really consider themselves political, but they are in a deeply politicized profession. I also know many, many librarians who do see that it is inherently a very political thing. And it is being challenged all the time by opposing forces. You know, I see libraries as the best application of our democratic values, you know, free speech and privacy and, you know, all those lovely things. You can see them on display in your local library.
Well, Allison, thank you for speaking with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Allison McCrina, she's a librarian, a privacy activist, and founder and director of the Library Freedom Project. You'll find a link to more on her organization at wordofmouthradio.org. Well, it's Thursday, time for another episode of the 10-Minute Writer's Workshop. That's Word of Mouth's podcast for a quick hit from behind the scenes with renowned writers. We ask them what really goes into their work and what keeps them from getting their work done. Today, musician and memoirist Patti Smith. I spoke to her in the green room of the Music Hall in Portsmouth just moments before she headed off into the spotlight for Writers on a New England Stage.
Hi, I'm Patti Smith, and we're at 10 Minutes Writer's Workshop.
So what do you think is harder for you to write, the first sentence or the last sentence?
Well, I think that the first and the last sentence, for me, are not hard at all. They seem to come as a gift. The hardest part is the middle. The first line and the last line, which I find are so infinitely important, always come to me without a problem. It's really the wrestling with all the stuff in between.
And when you're wrestling with that stuff in the middle, are there any personal habits that you would encourage writers to take up or avoid to be more productive?
Well, I wouldn't presume to tell anybody anything, but I think having routine is really helpful. For me, I get up early, go to a cafe, or if I don't have a cafe to go to my desk or somewhere early in the morning, the coffee, preferably when the city is sleeping, when people are sleeping, when you seem to own the universe, and spend some time with yourself writing and make that a habit. I try to do that every day. And I think, you know, writing is, a lot of it is discipline and labor. And we can be inspired at any time, you know, in the middle of the night, we wake up at 3 a.m. But we need, there's so much labor intensive work that needs to be done. It's good to develop a work ethic and a discipline. Also, to always have a notebook somewhere on you, or, you know, some piece of paper, some scrap, some pencil stub, because something comes to you at all these inopportune times, and there's nothing worse than thinking you have the line of your life and no pencil or piece of paper at hand.
And when do you go from that process of writing in notebooks to computer or your last stage?
Well, I've learned the hard way not to wait until I have mounds and mounds of work. I try, you know, every 10, 12 pages or so to transfer it onto, I have a little laptop. I always, I used to write everything by hand, but it was so tedious after a while and hard on my hand, because I write whole manuscripts over and over by hand, that I find the computer very useful. But I try to get a little bulk done.
Do you edit as you go, or do you wait to the end generally?
I generally wait, because you can get really tripped up editing, and you know, and get so involved in editing a segment that you lose your grasp on the whole. So I try to hold off in editing.
So what is your personal worst distraction from getting work done?
Detective shows. If I'm supposed to be working and there's a new George Gently, or, you know, or some, you know, some marathon, you know, every once in a while there's some, if I'm lucky, some CSI Miami marathon or something, that can be a little distraction. And it's a new distraction for me, because for years and years I didn't even watch TV. But since my detective addiction, I found that I have to discipline myself a little sometimes and do my work.
I should let you know that we were all planning on coming in big Icelandic linden-like sweaters tonight.
Fair Isle sweaters. Well, I have a nice postscript. I actually was asked, after the book was done, I was asked to be on the last little season. They were canceled. And when the book was done, the show was canceled. And I wrote a mournful letter to the producer. And then when she made a deal to make 6 more episodes, she asked me to, if I wanted to come to Vancouver to watch them film, and I said, of course. And then she sent me another message and said, well, why don't you do a little cameo role? And I was thrilled, and so I got to play Anne Morrison, neurosurgeon, and did a scene with Lyndon and Holder. And some months later, I got a box in the mail, and each of them had sent me a little souvenir of the show, and she had sent me one of her Fair Isle sweaters.
Wow.
So I actually own one. Not only do I own one, but I found some of her strawberry blonde hairs on it. So it's, I got the DNA evidence.
So what do you think the most common mistakes that new writers make, fledgling writers?
Oh, I don't know. I mean, I think that it's not a matter of making mistakes. It's just writing and writing and writing. You can't fault people for making mistakes when they're doing anything new. You know, it's just, you know, it's, you just keep writing until you find your voice. And, you know, we, you know, sometimes we mimic other voices, or we go through, you know, different phases, but a lot of that is necessary. And So I don't think of it as mistakes. I think of it as learning process.
Are there any, like, books or tools that you would recommend that people read to help them along in their writing?
Well, I don't read, like, those books that help you. I mean, you know, the books that, you know, there are books that people consult about grammar and structure and all, and I don't have any patience for them, but I think there are some good ones. If I want to learn about writing, I read writers that I like, and that's how I learn, you know, is just reading other writers, see how they do things, how they build a character, you know, their sense of rhythm. Writers are the best teachers to learn how to write, I think.
What was the best piece of advice you ever got from somebody about writing?
I think it was, might have been William Burroughs said, say what you mean. I was really having trouble, like, conveying a certain thing, and he said, just say what you mean. You know, like, step back and just simply, you know, say it out loud. If you're trying to, convey something and you're writing it on paper, sometimes you just get tripped up with language or in this labyrinth of language. So speak it out loud. See how it flies. See if it conveys what you're trying to say.
How many times were you rejected before you were published?
A lot. But truthfully, I was rejected quite a bit when I was young. Like, all my poems and everything was rejected. But then I haven't published that much. I've spent most of my life writing and not publishing. I have novels, unfinished novels, stacks of unpublished poems. I've only published about 1/10 of what I've written, and I really don't have the tendency to send my work out. It's just, if I think it's ready, then I just go and take it to somebody, see if they want it. Luckily at this point in my life, I can do that, you know. But when I was younger, I got rejected all the time. But I didn't really let it bother me. I just kept writing.
Thank you so much, Patti Smith.
You're welcome.
Well, there you go. Less than 10 minutes of packed wisdom there with Patti Smith, musician and National Book Award-winning author of Just Kids, and most recently, M-Train. I spoke with her backstage at the Music Hall in Portsmouth just moments before our interview for Writers on a New England Stage, which you can also hear in its entirety. You can hear more of these quick conversations by subscribing to our podcast, The 10-Minute Writer's Workshop. You'll find a link at wordofmouthradio.org, or you can search 10-Minute Writer's Workshop in iTunes. And if you do listen to the podcast, we'd like to know who you are and what you think. So please leave a review. It'll help other people find it, word of mouth style. Until next time, I'm Virginia Prescott, and this is NHPR.
Word of Mouth is produced by Taylor Quimby,
Logan Shannon,
Molly Donahue,
Megan Tan, and senior producer Maureen McMurray.
Our volunteer is Pam Maroney.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals
and not those of NHPR,
its Board of Trustees,
or its underwriters.
Word of Mouth is a production of New Hampshire
Public Radio.